So let us get started. Just another reminder, please don't feed the dog. She runs up to people on the path now and goes, "Oh, I want food." And she's never done that in her whole life. But it just goes to show you that one thing that they always say about behavior is really true, and that is that behavior, there's one consistent thing about behavior, is that it always changes. So they can always learn new things, you know, which is not what we had in mind all the time, but, you know. So, I don't know if that's right or something like that. Okay. So, before we begin or before we get back into the PowerPoint, so I'm walking this morning, I sent out some handouts, some things to read. I know some of you read it because you gave me feedback about the Norwegian. Yeah. I like their outlook. They're far more holistic, I think, than people who do the bits and pieces or the scientific studies of particular little bitty things, and they never take the whole dog into consideration. Like the study that you sent me, that was so interesting because the study was that the dogs are, they discovered that high baby talk voices are more effective for dogs because they respond to them more than they do to lower tones. And so they took some volunteers' dogs and they tested them out and they tested them on different kinds of voices, and they found that the baby talk voices were the ones that the dogs responded to. And I thought, this is about as unscientific a test as you could possibly do, because there's no, they're not doing any kind of blind testing on it. There's no comparative study of dogs that are different. Also, they discount something which is rather important in our dogs, learning. You know, if a dog learns that when you go, "You're a good dog," and you give them a treat, then they go, "Oh, I like that voice. That's a good voice," right? So, as opposed to, "Oh, you're such a good little thing," that could also be a good voice, but if that's followed by a smack, then that might not be a good voice. So, just the whole idea of being able to learn, to continue to do, to keep on changing behavior is something that I think is really interesting. It's like the other thing they do with wolf studies and dog studies, which is a kick and a half, which is like, if you point to the ground with a dog, the vast majority of dogs will follow your finger. Wolves won't do that. No way. Really? And did they grow up with people who point all the time? Oh, God. So, yeah. At least that particular study was a little bit better than this one, which was just kind of, "Oh, let's grab a bunch of dogs and see if they like people going, 'You did a good little puppy.'" You know? And the other thing about the baby talk stuff is, of course, just like babies and people, we tend to think that high voices are less threatening and low voices are more threatening. And that's because they are. And if you really want to intimidate your dog, growl at him, because that sounds very intimidating. So one of the other things that I thought of this week that I thought was worth passing on was just in that study, they were talking about the fact that they did this research involving the feral dogs, and they found that the feral dogs, the village dogs, had no fights. Zippo, none. No fights. There was no aggression in village dogs. And if you've ever seen photographs of village dogs, you know, there can be a whole ton of them in one area, or if you've ever gone to a place where there are some. And they don't have any fights. They don't fight over anything. Whereas we have a country full of civilized dogs who fight all the time. Right? And so one of the things that, in thinking about this today as I was walking on the path today, because we've walked past many, many dogs on our walk today, and Flocka, bless her little heart, goes, "I think I want to go meet that Akita." 12 pounds, you know. "I'm going to meet the Akita." And I said, "Flocka, you can't do that." Anyway, so one of the things that dogs do naturally is avoidance, right? They go, "Okay, there's something there that I don't really like, so I think I'm just going to go around here," okay? But there are a whole lot of dog trainers in this country who somehow think that dogs should be able to walk right past another dog right like that and have no problem at all. And as a matter of fact, if you do a study yourself, do a really scientific one, and you know, go into downtown San Francisco and just watch for a while, you'll notice that people do the same thing. If there is somebody who looks a little bit threatening or whatever, well, I think I'll just walk around here. So we do avoidance as well. So the idea that dogs should be able to learn to walk right past another dog without taking into consideration the way the other dog looks and whether the other dog is intimidating or friendly looking or little or big or whatever is ludicrous. And it's funny because sometimes I watch a lot of videos of dog trainers that I disagree with, just in an effort to make sure that I continue to disagree with them. It's like I watch Cesar Millan every once in a while, I go, yeah, I disagree. But because he's got some good things that he does, and you can't kind of discount everything that he does, but there are some things that I find very cruel, and I do not like the way he does it. So I watch all these videos, and they're like, okay, this dog should be able to do this. And then they walk through, and the poor dog is going, all right, I guess I'll do it because I'm more scared of you than I am of the other dogs, which is kind of how that works. So it is just interesting to think in terms of, and that's what I like about the Oslo conference, is how good they are at accepting that dogs are a species that has developed its own way of actually communicating with each other, and it works. In most cases, it works. So then you take a bunch of dogs, you put them in a shelter, and they're all really close to each other, and then we're amazed that they can't behave like a street dog. They can't choose avoidance. You always have to remember that this is the only species, as far as I know, that we actually tell them when they can go to the bathroom. Not just where, but when. We don't do that to our children. We don't do that to cats. I mean, my God, you have 15 cats. So we don't do it to anybody else, we do it to them. And bless their hearts, they try. They do their utmost to do what we want them to do. And then we get really upset if they have an accident. Like, oh my God, you had to go to the bathroom and you didn't go outside. I couldn't go outside. You didn't go outside. You didn't hold it. I couldn't, you know. Okay, so that was my diatribe for this morning.
Feel better.
Yeah. You kind of walk along and just thinking all these things, and I'm going, I have to spill it to somebody. I talked to Trish, and she goes, yeah. Because she already knows all this stuff, right? And she goes, you're just finding this out. And I go, no, I'm rediscovering it. As I get older, I keep rediscovering things. So another thing I rediscovered when I added it onto the PowerPoint is that territorial dogs and people do not pay attention to the signals the other person is giving out. And since we were talking about territoriality the last time, this is a really important consideration. So one of the things I actually wrote about this dog and whatnot. This is German Shepherd flock guard. She's madly trying to find a home for this dog. And he has bitten two people and one dog. And it now has gotten to the point where they're not going to be able to surrender this dog anywhere because the dog would be euthanized. And he's only like 10 months old. And they're working with a trainer who uses an e-collar on the dog. And then I came in for a consult. And what they're teaching the dog is that it has to stay back beyond a threshold. So if somebody comes in the doorway this way, there's a threshold over here, and the dog is supposed to stay behind it. And they're using a shake can to do that, and then they're using the e-collar to do that, I believe. I'm not sure about that e-collar on this one. Anyway, so it works if they're prepared for somebody to be there. And what happened was the UPS person came, and the kid in the family opened the door. And the dog bit the UPS person because there was nobody there to use a shake can or whatever to get the dog back at the threshold. And so this is so brought to mind with that. You know, this is, the dog is not thinking about who is this person, what is he doing here, is he a friend, is he a foe? He's going, stranger! And I'm going to get there. And so this is one of the reasons why territorial aggression is so pervasive. And the other thing is that we need to realize that all aggression is about space. So it's almost better to think in terms of space aggression, you know, with territoriality and or resource guarding or any or anything else, because it all has to do with space. It all has to do with the space or the lack thereof. Yes.
Talking about the village dogs and they don't have any fights.
They don't have any territory either.
So it made me think about when I took my dogs up to Lake Tahoe and all the, and my dogs leisure after, but all the dogs around there run around.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess I don't know 100%, but every dog, they were all friendly.
Yeah.
They did not, they were never aggressive to my dogs, although my dogs were leash reactive. At 2 a.m, they were running around, and it was, you know, and they, I did not meet one unpleasant dog. So, I mean, I didn't try to pet them, but they were just like.
Yeah, because you were giving them the space that they needed.
So why is there no territoriality just because?
Well, if territoriality implies resources. In order to be territorial, a dog has to have something to defend. So that would include, in the case of territoriality, a home, an apartment, or a piece of land or something. In the case of something like resource guarding, it's a lot smaller. There can be a bone or whatever. Well, with street or feral dogs, they don't live in a home. They wander, right? So they don't have any defined territory. And if they get something that they want to have, they will defend it, and everybody else knows that they'll defend it, and so they don't have to worry about that. I mean, I suppose the little ones probably do have to worry about it, because a big dog might just come and take it away from them. But essentially, if you take the territory away, you take away an awful lot to defend. But we are territorial, and we are extremely territorially oriented. So what we've done is we've created territories, and then the dogs are within those territories, and then they defend those territories. So, yeah.
Do the village dogs also then give themselves more space?
No.
I was looking back at some of the videos, but the dogs were like sleeping here, and then there was another one up here, but none of them were crowded.
No, they're not on top of each other, except for the families. But they give themselves 3, 4, 5 feet.
Yes.
But it's not huge amounts of space, depending on the dogs. I mean, there are some areas where there's not very many of them, and then they have a lot more space. But the thing about the territoriality is actually, you know, when you think about it, it all is resource driven. Okay, so if there's a garbage dump and all the dogs go over to the garbage dump and that's where they get their food, then the garbage dump is replenished on a daily basis by us messy human beings, and so there's no fighting over food. So they don't have to worry about those resources, so they don't have to worry about the territory around the garbage dump because it's always being replenished and moved and all that kind of stuff. Whereas if you live in a house, all the resources, as far as she's concerned, or was until we started coming here, food, as far as she's concerned, where we live is extremely valuable because that's where everything is. That's not only where all her love and affection is, all where all the food is and all that kind of stuff. So that becomes extremely valuable. So if you discount the value, so you have a dog that is on a farm which doesn't have any fences, and there's a dog on a neighboring farm, they'll have these really big territories, and they probably won't even try to fight each other off until unless someone comes into their house. So if now we have a core territory. Now, as I said before, in the first course, in the Instincts course, we talked about the fact that there's a core territory, the secondary territory, and the tertiary territory. They've got territories that get bigger. And wolves have all three. Coyotes have one. They only have the core territory. Because they are not particularly territorial. They don't have wolves have like a 500 square mile area that they will patrol, and they will go after that food in there. But coyotes don't. They're like dogs. They are opportunistic scavengers. So they're going to go and find, a little thing here, and a little thing there, and a little thing there. But wolves have to eat big things. And the smaller the things they eat, the less territorial they are. So if they eat a bunch of rabbits, they're not very territorial because rabbits are everywhere. But if they eat deer, they're going to be really, really specific about their territory. So it's all resource-driven in the end. I mean, it's actually really interesting, too. Okay, anything else?
Let's say, for instance, you have your dogs in your backyard and they're barking, and that's
territoriality. Yeah.
So how do you work with that? Because if your dog is reactive to everything that they hear in their backyard, like nobody come in here.
Well, when you find out, let me know.
Okay,
so actually, there's a little dog I saw yesterday is the cutest little booger you ever saw. He was a little healer. They called him a mini healer. He's about that big. His name is Zeke, and he's extremely sweet. But they live in Fairfax, and they live in a house that goes along the main drag goes here, and so their house is kind of like right along here. So they don't have any windows on that side. They have a window over here that looks out over a garden and a sidewalk that not many people come on. So you would think this would be a very good place for a territorial dog because they don't see, there's no windows here where all the traffic goes by. He's made up for that. So he sits there and his ears are like, whoo, you know, and he waits for the sound of people walking past on the sidewalk, and then he races to the wall. He can't see out. He races to the wall, barks like crazy, then races through the house into the backyard. They have a little backyard that goes through the dog door and then into the corner of the yard where he still can't see, but he can hear everything and barks like crazy at the people going by.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's a purebred healer. And have you ever heard a purebred healer bark?
Yes.
It makes her sound good. It, I mean, that's the reason I don't get a healer, because their bark is one of the most god-awful bark. And so he's screaming, you know, he did it for me. It was really nice of him. He did it for me, and I'm like, ah! You know, it goes straight to your brain stem and hangs out there. And, you know, it's just really hard to deal with. And so they've got, you know, they've got an Amazon Echo that they leave the music on all the time. They've got a white noise machine. I mean, they've got all kinds of stuff. They closed the windows, or covered the windows, but the dog isn't seeing anything. He's all auditorily involved in here. And he also sees very well. He's got leash reactivity, so when they go for a walk, if they see the dog before he does, they can cope with it. But if they don't, he's got reactivity. And he is the sweetest little guy. He's just absolutely adorable. And he's so easy to work with, but he goes up to the vacuum cleaner. So this is a dog with high reactivity issues. So he goes after, I may even have a video of this. This is really funny.
Oh, what is it?
Okay, so, well actually the video is just not that interesting. The video is just of us doing counter conditioning with it. So I said, okay, let's bring out the vacuum cleaner. So they brought out the vacuum cleaner and he's going, and we're doing sit stays. So I wanted him to do a really long, you know, very settled sit stay. So we're doing sit stays and they bring the dog out. And then we bring the vacuum cleaner out, and we're moving the vacuum cleaner around, and the little dog is sitting there just quivering. He wanted to kill the vacuum cleaner so much. And he's got to stay in a sit, and she's giving him reinforcement. She's telling him he's a good boy. And I said, okay, now we're going to go put the vacuum cleaner away, and then we're going to release him from his sit stay. So that's what we did. And so I said, because her release word, the way they teach release words these days is kind of like, okay, well you do that to this dog and he goes through the roof. So you have to go, okay. And so he goes over, and she releases him, she says, okay, good dog, and he goes, okay, here I am. Goes over to the closet, walks in the closet and bites the back. And going out the door, she has him do all these kind of, it's a wedding march walk. It's like this, walk, sit, walk, sit, walk, sit, right out the door. And, you know, we're working on this thing too. And he goes, I'm good, I'm good, I'm good. He gets all the way out. She says, that's a good boy. She releases them and he bites a bush. He's bitten them.
Oh.
He redirects on them. He's an adrenaline addict. I mean, he's a true, absolute adrenaline addict with high degrees of territoriality, and just, you know, as kids are like, just absolutely adorable. So, you know, they're like, they're both teachers, and they're saying, what do we do? And I was talking about what to do with it, and essentially, it's really just teaching impulse control exercises. Yeah. That's really what it is. And they said, they wanted me to walk through every single teeny, itsy-bitsy step, because they said, we need all the steps. So we walked all the way through the steps. Whereas, and then somebody else who has three Portuguese water dogs that was fighting, I saw them, or I talked to them on the phone because they live in Pleasanton. And I'm giving them a lot of advice, which we can talk about a little bit later. And the guy goes, okay, so are there steps or is this gestalt? And I said, I'm sure it's gestalt. What is that? If you would define that for me. He said, is it just feel? And I said, it's gestalt. Yes, because when you're working with dogs, that's all, you know, it's you're working with a dog and you're trying to figure out how that dog is going to get along with another dog. You're watching the body language. You're going through feel. It's your feel, his feel, and all that kind of stuff. So this, my new word, Gestalt. We're doing it that way. Didn't I used to have a therapy that was Gestalt?
Yeah.
Was it kind of feely, touchy, feely stuff? Is that what it was? What's that?
It's a bar in Fairfax.
Okay, so territorial aggression, the behavior mod is for primarily management, blocking views of neighborhood activity, but as we pointed out, that doesn't always work, because they hear things. I'd invented the calming cap so the dogs can't see that well. I keep thinking there's got to be some earplugs. There's got to be something I can do with their ear. So blocking the views of neighborhood activity is important. Not allowing door greetings is really important. For instance, the German Shepherd mix I was talking about, I want them to put the dog away. Because I think that using the shake can, at some point he's going to override his fear. Well, it certainly makes it creates anxiety. It doesn't necessarily create arousal, but it definitely creates anxiety. And the funny thing about this particular one was that they got Barkbusters, and Barkbusters always use to shake hands, because Barkbusters does primarily punishment training. That's what they do. And so they were, at least as far as I know, I haven't talked to any of them, but every time I go see somebody, they've got shake cans and throw chains and stuff like that. So they have this shake can that says Barkbusters on it, and you just, it's got little rocks in it or whatever. And the guy who came after him said, oh, that shake can's bad. Use my shake can. It's a better shake can.
Okay.
Yeah, no doubt. Absolutely no doubt.
I use quarters.
Yeah, I use pennies. You use what you use in there? I'm not even totally against shake cans. I think they can work in certain circumstances. I don't have a problem with them if they are used, you know, judiciously and appropriately, and as a good punishment is, that would be not very many times before you should be stopping doing it. But if you have to be constantly shaking this can and to stop your dog from doing something, you're doing something wrong. No.
Well, and you have to do it every time, right? So if the guy comes to your door and nobody's there to do it, like what's the
yeah, there's no reason for them to do it then, and they won't do it then.
Yeah.
So, but that's what I mean. If you are using it to go through the rules of punishment again, you need to use punishment. The punishment has to be appropriate, big enough. You know, the dog has to actually identify where it's coming from, and they have to identify what it's for. And in order for it to be efficacious, you need to use it as many times as necessary, but that should be no more than 3 or 4 times. So in other words, you should be using the shake can. You say, back up, if you're teaching threshold work, be back up or on the line or whatever the cue you want. And then if they don't do it, you might use the shake can. And then they go forward again, you use the shake can again. And then they go forward again, and then you keep telling them back up, and when they do it right, then you reward. But you shouldn't have to keep on doing the shake can. And the problem is that people get dependent on it. They get dependent on e-collars, they get dependent. The big reason why most items of punishment, punishment tools, like e-collars, shake cans, citronella collars, anything, throw chains, anything like that, the main reason they don't work, I shouldn't say this, one of the main reasons they don't work is because people don't use them right. And then, or they don't use them properly, or they don't use them to the point where the dog knows what the behavior is that you want. So if you're ever inclined to use punishment on a dog, and we all are, you have to remember that, you know, its effect is not necessarily going to be good if you forget to use it. So with Aspen, bless her little heart, we put her on a leash when we're all outside in the front playing, because as soon as somebody goes by, she barks at them. So she's on a leash and she's got her bully stick. And that's when she really eats her bully stick, because the other dogs don't get one. You know, so she's like. So she's on a leash, she has a bully stick, the other dogs are playing ball. If I forget to put her on the leash, she goes back to barking again. So there's your territoriality. So we have to consistently use this management tool in order to stop her from doing something we don't want. So disallowing door greetings, walks away from the house, and this is a really hard one for clients. They don't want to do it. They want to walk in their neighborhood, but if you walk in your neighborhood, dogs increase their territory. So wherever they walk, especially if they pee there, that's theirs. And, you know, at the beginning of trailheads and whatnot, you'll see dogs spend a lot of time peeing right there, and then they do all that. They're all setting up territory there. And the big fights you see at trailheads, those are the fights at trailheads, at where a dog jumps out of a vehicle and goes after another dog. So they're very much a territorial kind of thing. On the trail a little bit, you know, 100 yards down the road, they wouldn't be fighting. It's really interesting. I've actually sat and watched that. I watched the dogs going, I'm going to jump out of this car and I'm going to get him. And then obedience in the yard, this is another thing that the clients have a real problem doing for some reason or other. They think that obedience is something that they learned and it's over with, you know? So instead of going out in the front yard and doing sits and comes and downs and stays, where that's if that is where the dog is doing the problem, they forget to do that. So Aspen has to do that kind of stuff, not that it helps. So one of the people I met on the walk today said, what kind of dog is she? And I said, she's a palm mix. And she says, oh, does she bark? I said, yes, she does. So obedience, and in the street in front of your yard. So with Luke, when we were really working hard with Luke, I would go out and do a lot of work on, a lot of fun obedience. He got really good in obedience right on the street in front of our house. We do not have very many people who drive past there, which is a good thing. So
wasn't it interesting that they said that the feral dogs didn't bark also?
No,
They didn't bark.
They're more like wolves in that.
Yeah.
Yeah, why didn't that get passed on?
Right.
Yeah. What a shame. Okay, so this is a case history of high territoriality and a really interesting case, and maybe somebody has an idea about it, because to me it was just amazingly dramatic. So this was an American Pit Bull Terrier. This is not the dog. Okay, this is a different dog. This was one of my favorite dogs at the Marine Humane Society. I took the picture and I love this dog. But the dog in question looked a lot like this dog. She was a 2-year-old pit bull. She was adopted through rescue. And it was down when we were in Santa Cruz. So she had lived with this foster for many months with no incidents at all. There had been no issues. And I went to this foster's home. And I can tell you that there probably, you know, maybe we just talk about what the foster's home looked like. The foster mom had at any given time 4 or 5 foster dogs. She had a very small house, and so the dogs had kind of areas. She did have some big kind of pen areas in her house. It was very difficult to breathe in her house. I remember that because it was just she had a full-time job on this stuff, and it was really hard for her to keep up with it. So the house was stinky, So she had that, and she had a German Shepherd. When I saw her, she had 2 little dogs, 1 German Shepherd, a Mastiff type dog, and this girl, Ruby or whatever her name was, and I think another dog or 2 of her own. And there were no issues in this house. They had never had an issue. She didn't, when they placed this pity, they thought everything was going to be fine because she didn't have any dog problems, she didn't have any people problems. It was good. So she was faced with people who actually had never had a dog before. They weren't just fairly inexperienced. They were very inexperienced. And they loved her. So immediately, as soon as they got her into the home, she got to get up on all the furniture. They were constantly giving her treats. They were rolling around on the floor with her. They were hugging her and kissing her. And she ate it up. She just thought it was great. And I went there, I think, maybe 2-3 days after they adopted her. And I fell in love with her. I just thought she was utterly fantastic and a really good placement, and she's gonna do well. So then I said, well, why don't we do a follow-up? Because the rescue wanted me to do a follow-up like 2 weeks down the road. Not very much time, just a little bit down the road. And they said, okay. And then I got there. They emailed me the day I was supposed to go there, and they said, be careful when you come in. Because we had an incident last night. And I'm like, okay. So it was 2 days, it wasn't even 2 weeks. They were just in house training, excitement, stuff like that. It wasn't even a week or whatever. So they'd gone out the previous night, and I think there were two kids in the house and the two adults. So they'd gone out with these friends, and everything was fine when they went out, but they went out and met the friends. And then the friends came home to have a drink with them and to meet the dog. And they were all a little loaded. So they got into the house. I think the kids were old enough to take care of themselves. They didn't have a babysitter. They got into the house, and she went after the man, the couple. She just went after him. And she didn't bite him. She knocked him on the ground, and they pulled her off. And then they put her in her crate. She had a really big crate over in the corner. And she just, the rest of the evening, they stayed for a while, she just screamed. Screamed and barked and yelled and screamed and screamed. She was really highly, highly aroused. So they decided that maybe it wasn't a good time to have these people over, and they went home. So the next day, I'm coming over. So I got into the house, and there we go. Oh yeah, they tried taking her out again, and she lunged again. So I visited the next day, and Ellie let me in the door. She was okay. She could leave me, let me in the door. And then she stared, grunged, growled, and lunged. And it was a deep body lunge. It was this kind of lunge as opposed to, I'm used to getting, I had a German Shepherd go after my hand the other day. So, but this was like, I'm going to get you in your belly. Because dogs will tell you where they're going to bite you. Most shelter people know this because they go, okay, he keeps going up. I don't like this, you know. So they put her on a leash, and then they took her and put her on the couch. And when on the couch, she just kept growling at me and growling at me and growling at me and growling at me. And did I tell you about this already? Mm-hmm. Okay, good. I'm just suddenly thinking maybe I told them. So if I moved towards the stairs, her growl would turn really deep, and then she'd try to pull off. And so we talked for about 45 minutes, and I was very proud of myself. I did not let on that I was really needing to go to the bathroom or anything, you know, because this dog was really scary. And considering that a few days before she'd been great, it was very, very disconcerting. And so I said, okay, we didn't want to put her in the crate because we knew she'd probably scream if she was in the crate. So finally, I just said, look, I think you need to return the dog to the rescue because you guys are not. You're not set up for this, you don't know what you're doing. I don't know how to help you with this, and we know that she's okay at the rescue. So they said okay. They were very upset. So then I took her back to the rescue, to the same foster home, and she went back to her behavior where I saw her the following week and she was fine. Okay. So, what do you think? Yeah.
She had no school sites.
You mean she didn't have enough structure or boundaries or anything like that? Yeah, I think that was certainly part of it, for sure. Yeah.
She felt safer with the other dogs there.
Yeah, I think that could be. She could have felt like she, because she had no rules. I mean, who knows? But because she had no rules, maybe she felt that she was in charge. And since she was in charge, she didn't know who was safe and who wasn't safe. So that certainly could have been something. Yeah.
Maybe in the foster she had to share resources, and so it sort of took her down a few notches that they all...
They were all sharing so that it wasn't as big of a deal.
Yeah,
yeah, that could also be part of it.
Well, it sounds like the foster must be much more structured too.
No, the foster was one of the most unstructured people I've ever met in my life. Yeah. No, she was just a goofy, lovely, sweet woman who just thought dogs were totally benign.
I think it has to do with status. She was all of a sudden a princess in the new home.
Yeah, I think she actually developed territoriality in this new home,
yes,
where she never had it before. And I think all those things you're talking about played into this. No boundaries, no structure, given too many perks, and then the fact that she's the only dog. All these things, I think, probably had to do with it. Yeah.
So there was something when you were moving towards the stairs.
That was really weird.
Was the kids moving towards the stairs?
No, she would be sitting on the couch, and I would just kind of go like this just to test out. And as soon as I moved towards the stairs, and now I'm thinking about it, I think that one of the children she'd really, really taken to. So I think there was literally some protectiveness going on here, that I was a stranger and I was going to hurt her kid.
Yeah. Maybe she was picking up really weird vibes from people that they hadn't been drunk around before. Maybe
she they'd never seen me and met her before. Yeah, so, I mean, she...
The kids were home when they came over, when they all came home.
The kids were either, I think they were in bed.
So she, but they were home.
They were home. Yeah, so that might have been part of it, too. Yeah. In any case, it was such a complicated thing.
So, would you recommend her being adopted to the right home?
My recommendation was that she not be adopted. As far as I know, she is still in the foster home. Because, you know, that she's very successful in that home. But knowing that her, I mean, she was deeply, deeply aggressive. She really wanted to hurt me. And the only reason she didn't was because she was on a leash. So I think that it would be irresponsible to adopt her out to somebody else.
Did the rescue know why she was, you know, how did she come to the rescue?
She was a stray, I believe. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And there, as you know, there's a lot of strays down in that area.
So is the rescue, is the fostering keeper?
As far as I know, I've lost touch with the foster, although she took SIGA, so she took the academy, so I could get back in touch with her and find out what happened to her. She, you know that picture of the German Shepherd with the mouth like that I have here? That's one of her dogs, too. Yeah. They were fine together. They were fine together. There's no problem. Weird, huh?
It seems so fast.
What?
It seems so fast, like from her to go to the foster and then just...
Yes, it is. It was a very, very... And I think that's one of the things that we need to take away from this is you know how I said behavior always changes? Sometimes, apparently, it can change very radically, very quickly. And I think if you work in a shelter environment, you know that, because there's a bunch of people in a shelter who might very well say, oh, this is the nicest dog in the world. And then another person comes over, and all of a sudden, like you were talking about with the German, the dog that didn't like men. And they can turn from being angels...
Yeah.
To being terrifying within a very brief period of time. And if they didn't have lips, we wouldn't have pets. I mean, if we saw those canines all the time. So I thought that she was much more unstable than either the shelter or I had seen. I think obviously she had some insecurities that we didn't know. And we also know that after adoption, it takes 3 weeks or so for a dog to really get into a feeling of being at home. So you got your honeymoon period, and normally I don't even go visit people before their honeymoon period is over, unless they have some kind of overriding problem and they're thinking about returning the dog, but they would like to get a second opinion about it. So there was that was going on for sure. Then as we indicated already, the owners had allowed Ellie to take over the territory, she got too much freedom too soon, or too much responsibility too soon, not even freedom. And then we got him back. So.
You know,
Trish, that was the other thing. That can occasionally showed random aggression towards dogs and humans. Yeah, she did do that, but as far as I know, she didn't do it in the home. Yeah.
When you go through dog tech, they tell you don't take on a client if they only have the dog a short time. They need to get to know the dog better, and you should not take them as a client. You should tell them to wait.
I don't say that I won't take him as a client.
No, like if they've only had the dog 2 weeks, they need to get the dog. Let's
make an appointment a couple
exactly.
weeks down the road.
That's exactly what they tell you. If they've only had the dog a few days or a couple weeks.
Yeah, but people want to start. I mean, the people who adopt a dog often take the dog to the dog park that afternoon. And then are amazed when the dog isn't recalled. And then the other thing they do is they start to, they either give the dog too much freedom, as these people did, or they think that the dog has already bonded to them because they bonded to the dog. And so there's, and they don't expect the dog to take any time to kind of settle in. But, you could sit and talk to adopters until you're blue in the face, and they still don't think you know anything. So, you just work here, and, you just have a lot of experience. But this is this dog, and this is me. I'm so much better than everybody else. Okay, so this is the GSD Pyrenees that I was talking about. And that is not him, but he looks just like that. He's so cute, he really is. Now there she's really looking for a home for him. So if you know anybody who wants a dog looks like that, let me know. Because
this is the shake dog?
This is the dog that, yeah. And I think one of the things that's going on with this dog is he no longer thinks the world is safe. So they went to a behaviorist in San Francisco, a veterinary behaviorist, who said that she had fear-based aggression. And I know he does have some, but it is exacerbated because of the territoriality. And she recommended maybe some Prozac. And then when I talked to her this past week, I said, yeah, go for that. You know, because you're not going to find a home for the moment. And unless you want to euthanize him right now, which would be a real shame, why don't we try some Prozac and see if you can drop the anxiety level down. That could drop the territoriality down. And from what Nick Dodman says, you don't get a situation with Prozac, you don't get happy biters, which is what we're worried about. You know, take the anxiety away and they're just going to go and bite. What happens is they don't feel the need to bite, is what it is, you know. Prozac allows time for learning, so it's like giving CBD or anything like that. If you're very anxious and you had to go on some kind of medication, but then you could learn new behaviors, then you can go back off the medication again. I do think that people do what they do with anything else; they use it as a crutch. And so then the dog, if they don't do any work on it and they don't say, these are the rules of what you're supposed to be doing here, then the dog may end up being on it for a long time. I did, however, have one client, she's a good friend of mine now, who had a dog who had fear-based aggression towards other dogs. I met her when she was, I was at Marin Humane Society, and I was walking outside and she had this dog that looked like an Aussie mix. And it was barking like crazy to everybody's going by, and I said, I bet you're my client. And she goes, yeah. So he was a nice dog, but he was highly anxious. When I took him for a walk, he had no issues. He walked with my dogs. My dogs were the only dogs he got along with. We never had any problem. So we used to go for walks quite often because she lived close to me, and I'd tell her if another dog was coming, you back off. So she'd go someplace else, and then the dog would be fine with me. But she never could make it so that the dog was okay with her. And this is a really good lesson for me. It's a really good lesson. It's like, okay, you've got this dog, and you're working with this dog, and it's fine. So a lot of times dogs are great with dog walkers, but not with the owner. And then the dog walker doesn't understand why it's a problem. And it's a problem because you're not the same person. And you can't be the same person. You can tell them to fake it until you're blue in the face. They can't fake it.
I find that the breed that's really common, I think dog walkers come with dogs all the time, and then the dogs come to my shop with their owners, and the dogs are awful. Mm-hmm. These friends, I feel it's kind of like, you know, when you're with your mom and you act like a brat, and then when you're out with other people, you're fine.
Yeah.
And I think that's good, because I just see that with really big consistency. It's like, dogs come to their kingdom, like, go away, get your dog walker
back. Bring your dog walker back.
With you,
yeah.
And they don't get
it. Well, they get frustrated. They don't understand why their dog is better with somebody else than it is with you. And in fact, if I go over to somebody's house and the dog starts doing stuff for me, they go, what do you do? And I don't know. I just stand there.
Yeah.
You know, and not all dogs do it either. Some of them are jerks with me too. So I guess it's just, you know, matching vibes or something. I don't know.
A lot of pet owners that are really nervous and they don't, and then it's not good for them to walk their dogs.
No.
Because they're super nervous with the dog because the dog has lunged and barked at other dogs. So they get worried, they tighten the leash, and then so they don't do it. And their spouses do it.
Well, the thing is that it takes a behavior history. So if you're a dog walker and you've been walking this dog and he's fine with you and he always has been fine with you and he's fine with the other dogs in your pack, you're not expecting any problems. So you're not nervous, you're fine.
Right.
If you have one episode with that dog where he bites another dog, you're gonna start getting nervous and then the dog will start acting out with you too. Because it cannot be over emphasized how much they're reading you, how much they pull from you. And I think at one point people denied that was the case, but you know, we know it's the case. They can smell pheromones. They can get your heartbeat. They get everything. They get a lot of info. Yeah.
And they also act differently because, like, they're protecting, or they get jealous.
Or they think you're protecting them. Yeah, yeah. And with a dog walker, they know there's this distance. Mm-hmm. They know that that you know, with a dog trainer, dog walker, the dog, they don't care enough about it. So that is very much like a child. You know, if I were a teacher and I wanted to punish a child by, you know, putting him in another room for or whatever, then I would just be doing this for the child's good or whatever. But the mother, the kid has a different relationship with the mom, and then all of a sudden you've got a whole drama going on.
Do you know, I find too, like, I don't put the dogs that I walk in a position where they feel like they, I don't walk in their dogs, I don't let them meet people, because that's not part of my job. I'm not there to, you know, unless I'm purposely socializing a puppy, which I'm not going to let people put their hands on. So the dogs, but oftentimes owners will walk, you know, oh my God, they walk by a dog, and the dog, and I'm like, they're like, does that happen with you? I'm like, no, because I don't go near dogs, and I don't go near people, and I do.
Yeah, so you're consistent, and the dog does not expect to go meet another dog.
They just don't have the, they don't understand.
And that's really important. Yeah. So stranger danger can be part of territorial defense. In fact, having a territory makes them bold. And sometimes having a pack makes them bold. And sometimes putting them on a leash makes them bold. So if a dog has stranger danger, they're going to go into arousal, and they'll probably go into a combo of fight-flight, which would be engage or avoid. And I think that that's a really important consideration with both territoriality and stranger danger, is that you'll get this thing where they back up and go forward and back up and go forward and back up and go forward. So they're actually conflicted. And, you know, Temple Grandin says that dogs cannot feel two things at the same, or animals cannot feel two things, two emotions at the same time. And I don't know whether she's right or not, but this is as close as you can get. Because they're feeling afraid, and so they're feeling the emotion of being afraid, but they're also being assertive, you know, trying to drive something away. Fearful dogs also might respond very aggressively on walks, particularly to people who look weird, or act weird, or stare at them funny, or have the wrong color hair, or limp, you know, or whatever. Whatever they've decided is different from the norm, they may do that. So. Here's another case. I saw these people yesterday. They have a Weimaraner. And it was interesting because the person who contacted me about the dog is a friend of the owner of the dog. And she actually paid for the consult. Because the dog is, she takes them, if you live in Marin, there's in Novato, there's a big mountain, Mount Burdell, where everybody walks their dogs off leash. It's off leash, you can do it. Right now, they're going to get fox tails, but you know. So people walk their dogs there all the time. There's also cows there. Cows and I don't get along, so I don't go there. My dogs were charged by cows. I don't trust them. So yeah, have you ever been, you know, kind of approached by about five cows at once?
Yes.
It is very intimidating. They're like this. Yeah, you're going. What'd you say? Yeah, right. So I prefer avoidance in this case. I don't go to Mount Burdell.
Do you eat a lot of steak?
So I keep telling them maybe I won't be a vegetarian anymore. You know. Especially milk cows are way nicer than beef cows. Beef cows are like, nah, why would I like you? Yeah, so anyway, so she goes up there to Mount Burdell all the time, and her dog was attacked twice when he was 6 months old or less. And so she did mention that in passing when I talked to her, and I said, okay, there's your reason for your dog being aggressive. So what she does is if she can catch it first, she moves the dog over to the side, she gives the dog food. You know, she does all the things that you should do. She's doing avoidance. It's really nice. But if the Wyme sees another dog first, so he goes racing at them, gets all the way up to them, barks and lunges and doesn't do anything else, but gets, you know, really, really into their face. And so the person who called me, the person who contacted me, said that the owner was in denial about the dog's problems and that she wanted to get the problems fixed. So most of this was a discussion about the fact that the owner was actually right on top of it, doing a very good job with it, and it was the friend who was wrong about the dog. Because the owner was doing everything, I said it very nicely. I did, you know, they were all there. There were three friends, and they were all there. And I said very, very nicely. But I just was trying to say, you know, you're trying to increase distance between the dogs, and that's a really good thing. And there was a point to this, and now I can't remember what it was.
Weird looking people.
Hmm. Well, he doesn't like bird-looking people either. Other than that, he's one of the nicest Wyomings I've met. I'm not that keen on the breed. And I said to them in passing, I said, well, usually the biggest problem with these guys is separation anxiety. And they all went, oh, yeah. So he's got separation anxiety. It's pretty common with that.
Is he off-leash?
He's off-leash, but they call him. And she says there is one trail where she never very rarely sees anybody. But I'm not going to Mount Verdell anytime soon.
Yeah.
Oh, look at the big Wyoming down there. Okay, we're going back this way. He's 90 pounds of power.
Yeah.
You know, they can be pretty big dogs.
So, because you said the owner's doing everything right, but if that dog was coming up cattail, they wouldn't put the dog on the leash.
Well, that's what she does.
Oh, she does.
If she sees anybody, she puts the dog on a leash, she moves over to the side,
okay.
She gives the dog treats. And what I told her to do, because she says she tries to tell people to control their dog, and I said, that ain't going to work. Because nobody knows how to control their dog. And they go, what? And by the time they understand what you're saying, the dog is all the way up to your dog. So it's like, you know, it's way too late and all that. So I said, what you do is you hold up your leash and you go, he's a jerk, which is what I do with Luke, right? Hold up a leash, point at the leash and say, he's a jerk, which essentially means get your dog on leash because my dog will attack your dog.
Yeah.
And then if that doesn't work, then I turn around and do this again, and then I turn around and walk the other way. And by that time, they think that I'm an antisocial bitch, so, you know, I'm leaving. But it works with Luke really well and has continued to work all the way through his adult life. What's the worst thing you can do is to try to put responsibility on somebody else to control their own dog. They can't do it. They don't know how to do it, and they get pissed off. And so then you have somebody yelling, and then the dogs get involved in it, so you try to keep your energy level as low as possible. Yellow, you know, they have these yellow... They don't work. The only people who know that they've got yellow ribbons are the people who have dogs with yellow ribbons. You know, so they don't work. Yeah.
I think probably my biggest issue with training is controlling my own emotions.
Yeah.
Is that I get so worked up so easily, whether, you know, just watching or see a situation, or we'll watch the video, I'm like, ah! I mean, I can't even imagine worrying about having a dog because I can't even contain myself watching a video. Do you have any,
I think that's experience. I think it's normalizing things a wee bit. You know, understanding that the behaviors that you're seeing are not abnormal, that they do, you know. It bothers me when people argue. I get upset when people argue. I want everybody to be nice and happy and all that kind of stuff. But with dogs, it's easier for me because I know they don't have self-awareness or that we don't think they have self-awareness. So I do get caught up in the human stuff a little bit, but I don't with the dogs. And I think that's just experience. Also the ability to draw back, to realize that if you're their trainer, their walker, or anything like that, there should be a distance between you. You're not their best buddy. You might be later if you really like this person. You might end up being, you know, a really good friend later. But in the beginning, you'd better keep a professional distance. And when you do that, I think you can knock down your emotions a wee bit. So, and also remember the videos I choose, that's why we don't have very many videos in this one, because it's really hard to get videos for this. But I choose them because they are going to be intense. And you're not going to like them, you know. Okay, so stranger danger, territorial management is really important. And then you might need to take preventive steps in the house for strict protocols about the arrival of guests, which again, you're trying to modify the behavior of people, which gets really difficult. Just trying to get a person to come in and sit down when they want to stand at the doorway and talk is really hard, so which is one reason why keeping the dog in the back room. And then people will say, if I put him in a back room, he barks all the time. That's right.
Better than a bite.
So, better than biting. But it's also, well, then put him in the back room every day for 5 minutes and give him a chewy there. Just start the behavior before you have to do, you know. You can't learn to drive on the freeway. Right? So you can't learn how to do good behavior if you're trying to do it in a crisis situation. You have to do it at other times. Yes, that's my newest one. It's like, you know, you can't take treats when it's really upset. And it's like, you know, if somebody handed you a piece of cake on the way down and being pushed after out of an airplane, you can't do it. Crisis situations do not allow you to learn.
Well, that was like the woman who had the Chesapeake who was crazy, but he just had she's like, well, how are you going to walk in without a prong? And I was like, because we start here. We don't try to do any kind of behavioral modification when there's 10 dogs walking by him.
Yeah.
It doesn't work. You have to start in your house.
Well, I think most people, I think maybe because of Cesar Millan, people think that that's where you do behavior mod, is that you do it when the behavior is happening. Because they often say to me, in fact, the people yesterday with the little bitty thing, they said, we usually put him away, but we left him out here so you can see how bad he is. I'm like, okay, thanks. Yeah. So, I mean, he was a little dog, he wasn't going to do anything. But the fact is that you can't, you know, they want to take him and say, when he's in the middle of barking and lunging at another dog or a person, that's when they want to punish him to tell him he can't do that. And what they don't realize is that you can punish him in that moment and it may actually work, but it's not going to work the next time they see somebody. So, yeah, you have to get driver training. I mean, you just have to begin at the beginning. Observation of a dog's ongoing emotional state, that's another thing that I really liked about the Oslo notes, is that just, in fact, I've read them for the last 4 years, I think, and all of those are on the website that I sent you, all of their notes are. And that's one of the things that's pervasive in that conference is the ongoing emotional state is extremely important, and that it can change by, you know, a feeling, a mild physical feeling or whatever. The other thing I really liked about them was when they're talking about going for walks. And in this country, we want to go for walks, whereas dogs have a tendency to go for sniffs, you know, for a lot of sniffing before they do anything else. And that fulfills a huge need in them. And I think that it's the hardest thing about greeting at doors. So a new person comes to the door, the dog, this is a novel person coming to the door, whether they like them or dislike them or afraid of them or whatever. And their first inclination is always to investigate. So if you don't allow the dog to investigate, what are you doing to the dog? You know? So what you do on walks is great because you're just doing avoidance and you just say, no, we're not doing that, and this is a rule, and that's good. But in a house, it's a little bit different. So, you know, I'm always torn about, okay, where do we go with this? And it probably depends on gestalt, right? Probably depends on the individual dog. So the dog I was talking about before, the Shepherd Great Pyrenees mix, he does very well if he is allowed to greet while you're standing still. But it takes him a while to get to the point where he can actually do that. Once he does that, he really likes you. Whereas some dogs that are fearful, they don't like you at all. So I want to ask you guys, who has a successful door protocol for people coming that the dog does not know and who finds that that is like 90% effective? Anybody? Yes?
But I don't know if this counts because I couldn't make out a tie down on his bed.
Sure, it counts.
Does that count? Okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
We tried all the training, worked for 2 years, and it was fear aggression. And now, if he's on his tie down on the bed, because we worked on that a lot before people came to the door, he doesn't even get up. So
you make a really good point here, which is you put him high. You put him on something.
Yeah.
Since he's fearful and you put him on something, he's likely to be a little bit less fearful. Mm-hmm. You find that's true?
Yeah, and it's off to the side. We originally had it like right by the front door. Uh-huh. And now he's like off to the side so he can still see that.
So he can see them. And then at what point does he get to meet the people?
About 15 minutes or so after. And we always say they can't touch him. Nobody talks to him. There's no treats. There's nothing. He does better if you just ignore him. And then about 15 minutes or so in, we put the leash on. And then same rules apply. And I just start walking with him around. And then eventually, I just drop the leash.
And then he goes up and investigates.
Yeah. But we don't do any, I give him the treat, and that works. But no food with him.
Well, I don't even think that food is a really good thing to use on fear-aggressive dogs until they're stopped being fearful.
Yeah.
Because you don't want to send them into conflict, right?
So
that's a really good one. And in fact, a dog I saw, I was going to talk about it anyway, the two dogs, so it's multi-dog issues. A 2 9-year-old dogs, one has suddenly started attacking the other one. The one that's attacking the other, the one is a Chesapeake Bay Retriever mix and the other one is a Chihuahua. So this is a really big deal.
Yeah.
But one of the ways, I might come back to those dogs, but the way they had the Chessie, meet the Chessie, is the Chessie's on his couch. And when you come to the door, you go over to his couch. And it's not something we normally think about, putting a dog on something high. But if, again, if you read the Oslo stuff, that the whole idea of lying on the bed gives the dog way a better view, and just the whole olfactory thing is a good thing. So if I were going to, you know, run a shelter, one of the things I would definitely do is have raised beds.
Yeah.
Because they're going to help the dogs feel a little bit more in control of their environment. So if you have a dog with some issues with visitors coming in, why don't you try putting him on something that's elevated? Because, you know, it's not going to hurt anything at all, and it might help. That's really good.
I have a client who has a German Shepherd, and he's leash reactive. A lot of it's because he has severe dysplasia, so he doesn't want other dogs coming up to him.
Right.
But when he meets people for the first time, she said he's wary. And so we met outside. We met away from the house, and
that's different than coming to the house. That's,
okay.
Yeah. And as a matter of fact, that's something that people have always said. Is like if I have a reactive dog,
yeah,
and somebody's coming to my house, one of the things you can do is meet out in the street and then come into the house.
And then we went into the house.
And it works in about 50% of times.
Okay.
And a lot of times the dog gets back in the house, turns around and says, "Who the hell are you and why are you here?" So it works until the person gets into the house. And then they go, "No, you can't come into this house." It's an interesting problem because it'll never go away. It's a huge problem because it's territoriality, then in some cases fear added in there, and I guess probably a lot. Because Strider, my German Shepherd, who was afraid of nothing, you know, somebody would come to the house and he'd go, "Hi, come on in. Jewelry's over there. Whatever you want." You know, he's a German Shepherd. They're not supposed to act like that. But he was so confident, he was so sure of himself that he wasn't afraid of anybody. He growled at one person once. Annie Black. You know Annie Black?
Yeah.
He growled at Annie Black, and we're like, "Annie?" Annie's this little bitty person who, you know, talks a mile a minute, and it's just really, really nice. And there's Strider going, "We had no idea. Maybe she just smelled like huskies, and he didn't like huskies that day. I have no idea." People are always asking me, "Why does my dog do this?" And I go,
ask your dog.
Yeah, ask your dog. Can't get the dog.
Project set on this. Or everybody's like, "What flavor should I get?" You get to project that yourself.
Yeah,
you get to project
that. Yeah, you get to be. You get to do whatever you want with the dog. That's why. That's why we love them. They can't say no. You were so wrong about that. You're totally wrong. Okay, so. The other thing that's really important about working with stranger danger or any other kind of aggression is that if a dog approaches his threshold, you really want to, you know, get out before rather than waiting until after. So this is the exact opposite of the more compulsive type trainers who wait until the dog is at threshold before they start to work on it. So it's much better to stop working before threshold. And just really try to gauge your dog's emotional state. So remember that learning takes place in bits and pieces, and if a dog is too emotional, they can't learn anything. If they're afraid, they're not going to learn anything at all. If they're angry, they're not going to learn anything. So if you all the stuff, this was a really good thing that, now I can't remember her name. It was one of the speakers that I really like. What she said was that, you know, dogs and people remember the last thing they were taught. So if you end a training session by going, "Yay, whoopee," that's what the dog remembers, which is maybe not what you want them to remember. Maybe you want them to remember they just did a nice sit down, sit stay or down stay, and you release them quietly, so now they carry that memory with them. So remembering that, so if you're working a dog at a threshold, and you go above threshold and you stop working then that's what the dog will remember. And again, we do the same thing. We remember the same thing. In fact, they did a study that was really cool where people were given a shot. I would not have been involved in this study. But they gave people a shot, and the one half, I think there were three, you know, there was a control group and then there were two other groups. And the shot was the same shot. But the first group, they gave the person the shot, and then they just said, "Thanks very much, you're done." And the second one, they gave them the shot, and then they sat and talked with them for a little while longer. And then they asked them, like 2 days later or 3 days later, what kind of memories they had of the visit. And the ones that had talked to the doctor for 2 or 3 minutes afterwards had a much better memory. The other ones remembered the shot, because that was what they took out of the office with them. So it's a good thing for us to remember, is that the last thing that happens is what you will remember, whether that's a really good thing or a really bad thing.
When taking yoga again, you always lay down at the end. I'm like, oh, that's why I keep going back, because I'm all happy.
Yeah. Yeah.
How much it hurts in the middle.
So if you have a dog that kind of gets agitated when he goes on a walk, which a lot of dogs do, they get, you know, they're kind of hyper or whatever, then giving them a massage right when they get back is a really nice way to end that, to have a really nice memory of that outing. So, you know, or to do Sue Sternberg's calming sit, which I really like. I haven't used it in a while because I don't have a dog that I use it with, but you essentially, you know, you sit, and then you're like this, and then you pet the dog as long as he's sitting, and then if he stands up, you stop petting him. And then if he sits down again, you start petting him again. And then he stands up, you get up. So you're constantly kind of reinforcing that relaxation. And the petting is important, because remember what our clients do. They go like this, and that is not petting. You know, that's not even pleasant. So it's very much a stroke, and it should probably start from right here as opposed to right here, although some dogs like it on their head, but a lot of dogs like it here. Sue used to use it for her shelter dogs. She would actually take them, now remember she only had 9 shelter dogs because she had a very small shelter, but she would take them to the, you know, just a bench, a park bench or whatever, and she'd sit there with them. And rather than thinking about walking them or whatever, because what we're trying to do with shelter dogs is try to make them calm, right? And so she would just sit there and she would do this, and they eventually got to the point where they would come in and just sit down there, because they were getting reinforced for sitting. But it wasn't like a sit, sit, sit. It was just reinforcement when they were sitting. Really a kind of interesting, very minor, but important behavior mod, you know? And certainly if you were working with a reactive dog, you might want to do that. You know, you take them to some place where they're working below threshold and you do a calming sit with them. So I kind of like that one.
Sorry, what was the name of that?
Pardon? It's Sue Sternberg. I don't even know if she, I know she used to do it a lot. I don't know if it's in any of her material now.
Sue Sternberg?
Yeah, Sternberg. She was called the Nazi of the dog training. Well, because she was very, very much in favor of euthanizing aggressive dogs in shelters. So it was, I'm saying it as though she was a, you know, really liked to euthanize. She didn't. But she was, when the no-kill movement started, she was given the name Nazi. She actually had death threats all the time. She's a really nice person. She's great. Now she lives in Utah on 500 acres. All by herself. Well, with her 5 dogs. But she loves healers, too. Yeah. She's got a Facebook, a very active Facebook page. I don't go on Facebook, so I don't follow it. But there, she has like several thousand followers or whatever. In fact, she was complaining that she couldn't get more than 10,000. They wouldn't let her. What's that called, a humble brag? Oh, I can't get any more than 10,000 followers. Oh, my God. But anyway, I really like her. I really like her stuff. I think that she was maligned unfairly. There is probably a little bit of reasonableness in some of the criticism of her, but not really as much as people think there is. So this is Carl Barks. I had to use his real name because I love it. And Carl Barks is a 15-month-old herd mix, social on walks with most people, indifferent with others, had bitten a few people, visitors, superficial bites, very, very worrisome to them. Adolescent, onset of the behavior problems, he was a very fine young dog, no problem at all when he was a baby, but this is very common, and so it was about when he was 9 or 10 months old that he started showing some issues, and I liked him a lot. Once he figured that I wasn't going to kill him, and so he wasn't going to kill me first. But the thing about this case that I loved was that the dogs and the people were very motivated and very intelligent. And so they were very much willing to work. So he actually was really interesting in that he was extremely social on walks. He had no problems on walks at all. It was all territoriality and all fear-based stuff in the territorial. So we did a combo of management and training, no doorway privileges. The visitors had to text first, which is kind of a nice thing that people can do now. And then Carl was put in the back in the bathroom. When everything was quiet and people had settled down, Carl was brought out and he went through a rehearsed show routine, which is why I introduced this, or put this in here. He did a whole thing. He did a spin and a twirl and a jump and a down and a, he did everything. He did a whole bunch of stuff. They had started off doing obedience, but I said, you know, the obedience seems to be making him more worried because they were worried, and so they were making this. So he started doing all these fun games, and man, it worked. It was just turning fear into fun really worked for Carl. And then after the intro, where he was then allowed to go up and sniff each person, they were not to touch him, so it was, you know, that was really important. And then he was put on a tether that was right next to his mom. So she had him right there, and she was ready to tell him he was a good boy when he was being a good boy. And if she saw anybody, she was a really good owner. You're never going to find an owner like this. If she saw that anybody was thinking about getting up, like that kind of thing, she would put a treat on Carl's bed. So she did very active counter conditioning. So people would start to get up and she'd put a treat down. And he did it. It worked. I talked to them about once every 6 months, and I saw them a few years ago. And I think, what did the husband say? Oh, husband says, he understands our routine for meeting people and in fact has oscillated pretty far forward towards the I love company end of the spectrum. As long as he doesn't see them come through the door. So he's good as soon as they're, as long as they've taken the territory first, then he's really good. But I liked the oscillated pretty far towards that spectrum. I thought that was pretty good. Not as good as Gestalt, but you know. Okay, so we'll go on a little bit and then we'll take a break. So familial aggression to me is what familial is aggression within a family towards the people. So it would be a dog that goes after children or is intolerant of kids. A dog like the dog that we dealt with. Have you heard anything about that dog?
Teddy?
Yeah. Pardon?
I thought you would hear from
Yeah, her. She wrote to me not too long ago, but she was still trying.
So he hadn't improved?
He's not going to improve. He's broken. He's a broken dog, you know. There are such things. There are psychotic dogs. Yeah, he's a psychotic dog. So intolerance to handling is a really common one for people to get bitten. Redirection, as we can tell from the fact that the people with the healer get bitten all the time. Status issues is not as big as people think it is, but it definitely exists where two dogs are going to fight over status and the person gets in the way. And sometimes status issues include people. So sometimes dogs have a higher status over people and that can cause issues themselves. And kids or whatever. Okay, so this is, I'm calling him Grok, that's not his real name because she's a current client. This is his picture when he was a puppy. The couple have very little experience and they have a Great Dane pup. The husband is away a lot, and in fact, I talked to her last week and they're getting a divorce. So I was like, okay, this is awful. Two small children at home, and I mean small, little toddlers, little ones. The dog is naturally rough and overbearing. When I met him, he was a puppy and he was nice, but I didn't like how mouthy he was. Now, I don't know Great Danes that well. Anybody here have a lot of familiarity? Yeah? Huh? I can't hear you.
I've worked with them, they seem to be jealous.
Jealous? Mm-hmm. I've seen a lot that are kind of got some fear reactivity issues. Mm-hmm. You've seen the jealousy. In this case, this dog, and it might just be this dog, is very rough with the kids, even when he had the puppy teeth. And so we, you know, trying to, in a fairly small house in San Anselmo, trying to figure out places for the dog to be able to go that the kids aren't going to go. It's really hard when you've got a dog that's going to get that big. You know, he doesn't get up on the couch. He walks over to the couch and just slides on it. Because he's a big dog. You know, just, well, here I am. I'm just, so trying to keep him off the furniture is really difficult. There's all kinds of stuff that really make it really hard when you're dealing with a giant breed. The children became fearful, although a video I'm going to show you shows the children not fearful at this point. But when the kids start beginning running around being afraid, guess what happens? The dog starts chasing them. And the children then didn't want to be around the dog. So, okay, so I'm going to see if I've got that video right here. Okay, so this is him now. And with the kids. And this is after a lot of conversation about should I keep the dog, should I not keep the dog, should I keep the dog, should I not keep the dog, and I'll tell you where I'm going with that. But I just wanted to show you, I asked her if it was okay to show this video, and she said yes. Can you see it okay?
Yeah.
Okay. So these are, whoops, dang it. I got to get it back again. So these are very normal children. She goes, you think they're normal? I said, yes, they're normal. Yeah, she goes, I don't know if they're normal or not. I said, they're normal kids. No, this is them playing with the dog. He's actually doing really well.
Off the couch.
Look how big he is. And he's still 9 months old. There's rice grabbing him everywhere. They're normal kids. Remember the video I showed
about
the
little
boy holding the dog? Yeah, these are normal
Bussy.
Children.
He didn't bite you. Why are you walking? Maddox, do not pull him like that. Stop. Hey.
Don't do that. There's this misapprehension that people, that parents can control their children. There's as much of that as there is a misapprehension that people can control their dogs. You know, it's and particularly this woman works full time. As I said, she's getting a divorce. This is not a good situation at all. But that's the dog.
He's very tolerant.
That amazed me.
Yeah.
Actually, I was really surprised. But the thing is, he's tolerant in play, but when he's resting, not so much. He's bitten both the kids like 3 times on their face. Not hard, you know, just making marks. But and that's when they are trying to approach him if he's resting. Yeah, this is a disaster waiting to happen, isn't it? I'm going to send them to you.
Yeah, thank you. Because I am in this class. We're just finishing our expectant parent section with all the things you can do to get the dog ready, and we're starting the toddler section now tonight. And I see this stuff and my blood pressure goes through the roof. And
yeah,
I'm,
you just like
I'm starting to sweat. I'm like, oh shit. You know what? I was like, thank God, the dog is being good. The dog was avoiding them. The dog was doing all the right things. But
the dog's got something in its mouth, which is really nice.
Yeah, no, that's exactly what I was thinking. But as you were talking about nap time and resting, I'm thinking there needs to be no access. Like there needs to be.
Yes, there does. There need to be no access.
Well, that's what has to happen.
All right, she's got a nanny. She goes to work. The nanny doesn't know how to handle the dog. This is a situation that is essentially set up for failure.
Yeah. Well, and if kids come over to play, because all the education, there's all the steps that have to happen, right? So first you need the safety zones in the house. This class calls them success stations, right? So that you have these areas that are going to succeed.
Oh, that sounds so cute.
I know. And euphemisms work wonders to get people to feel good.
Yeah.
But then it's like, okay, the kids have to learn, the parents have to learn, the nanny has to learn, the kids who visit for play dates have to learn.
And they can't. They won't. The frustrating part is that, you know, you have to accept human nature for what it is, and then you have to figure out ways to make it fail safe. Yeah.
Well,
so at this point, she said they're thinking boot camp, you know. And I said, well, I said a boot camp is good.
Boarding school.
Yeah, let's send her to boarding school.
They go to the boot camp.
That's it.
Did you tell her what you're thinking?
Oh yeah, we've had many long conversations. She keeps going, "I'm going to pay you more money." I said, "Don't worry about that. Just take care of your kids," you know.
Yeah.
So yeah, the couple was thinking either maybe a day trainer, which would be a good idea, but I don't know very many day trainers would come over. And working with the dog is not as important as working with the family in this case. But I really am going to give them your name.
Great.
And then I'm thinking return to breeder. Before he bites, I want him to be returned to the breeder. So I also said, he's not neutered and he's mounting everybody. And, well, he's a Dane. You can't neuter, if you neuter a Dane when they're young, you're going to cause many bone problems. So the breeder wants her to keep him intact. But the problem is he's starting to mount. And he, you know, he's probably doing a lot of Fleming, but that's not as big of a deal. It's the mounting that's hard, and it's hard on the kids because they'll mount anything they can get a hold of, right? So I said, okay. So I sent her to. I said, if you want to go to boot camp, she says it costs $3,000. I said, I know it's really expensive. So there's a guy who does boot camp who would be okay for a dog like this. It wouldn't be okay for a really sensitive dog, but he'd be okay for a dog like this. So I sent her to him, and she says he's too expensive, and she's found this place down in LA that's a lot cheaper. And I'm like, so I looked them up, and I'm thinking, okay. So they have multiple people training the dog, which means the dog isn't going to learn beans. And so Sapir would at least do a way better job of doing it. And, you know, I don't know. So this was the last time I've talked to her was when she sent this video, and she said, I think we're keeping him. That's yesterday or the day before. You know, 3 days before that, she's going to give the dog up. She does have somebody who wants to take him, and I'm going, take it. But this isn't even aggression, is it? Except for he's bitten them, the children, on the face. Which tells you what? That when he bites them hard, where is it going to be?
On the face.
And dogs tend to bite children on the face anyway, because the face is right there. Although maybe the Dane could face him right here. I had one case, this is a long time ago, where a dog, an Akita, took an entire kid's head in her mouth. Just the entire, and the guy goes, well, it was an accident. And I said, that's not an accident. You know, this is a big deal. And he's going, well, she didn't mean anything. No, she's just like somebody who takes out a gun and shoots somebody and goes, okay, that was not a problem. You know, I mean, it literally put holes in all parts of the dog, the child's head. So this is what I would call inadvertent aggression. And it's really because the wrong dog is in the wrong home. But it's still aggression, and it still could lead to the dog being euthanized. Because if he bites somebody on the face, which I've tried to talk to her about, if he actually bites and you end up having to go into quarantine, and especially if they file a complaint, you're going to find it, you're not going to be able to find a home for this dog. So looking down the road, remember we talked a long time ago about I can't remember the term for it, but how far people look in the future?
Event horizon.
Thank you. So the event horizon is how far somebody can look into the future. And what's fascinating about it is that you would think as an adult, you could look in the future. You could look to the future and go, okay, if this continues the way it is right now, and I don't have the resources to make it get better, it could get worse. And I just think, but apparently 60% of people don't have enough money to retire on either. So we obviously have, you know, this much of an event horizon. There are certain people in the White House who don't have any event horizon at all. They're living in the present. So, okay. Let's take a break before we go to this lab.